when wilt thou save the people? O God of mercy, when? Not kings and lords, but nations, not thrones and crowns, but men. Flowers of thy heart, O God, are they? Let them not pass like weeds away. Their heritage, a sunless day. God save the people.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Videos This Week on Broadway for Saturday, February 18th, 2012. My name is James Marino, and on our broadcast this morning, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a writer for the New York Star Ledger. You could see his writing also at Kritzerland on Friday, on Masterworks Broadway on Tuesdays, and also for the MTI block all throughout the month. Good morning, Peter.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a writer and photographer. You can see his writing and photography at BroadwayStars.com. You can see his photography at FollowSpotPhoto.com. He also writes for NPR and for the Sondheim Review, as well as other outlets like Arts America. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
All right, so we had an opening this week on Broadway called Shatner's World. Peter, why don't you tell us all about Shatner's World?
Well, frankly, I didn't think I was going to like this show at all because I figured I would be in the dark about it because I expected him to talk a great deal about Star Trek. You know me in TV. I've never seen an episode of Star Trek, not one. So I thought there were going to be plenty of inside jokes and that would happen. Actually, it didn't happen. And in a way, I think he's doing his fans a disservice because I think the people who came there came to hear about all. I'll never forget the time when Leonard Nimoy did this. And there's very, very, very little of that. I would say that that might be somewhere to 2 to 3% of the show. And so I don't think he's delivering the goods because I kind of imagine.
Wow, that's amazing.
Isn't it? I can't imagine people coming there saying, we want to hear about the world of Susie Wong. That'll be great. You know, I mean, I just don't think so. He almost spends as much time talking about the play he did on Broadway, The World of Susie Wong, saying that it got lousy reviews out of town, it got lousy reviews in New York, which rather surprised me because it ran 500 performances, which was not easy to do in those days. It isn't today for a play, but I mean, back then, it was reasonably rare. And it was a David Merrick production. And is this an example of David Merrick once again ballyhooing a show to make it into a hit? I don't know. I would have liked to have known, but he didn't tell me that either. Frankly, I thought the evening was reasonably boring because so many times he told stories and you're licking your lips thinking, this is going to have such a great punchline. And many of these stories did not have great punchlines. And you could feel the audience was waiting for the next line and then suddenly realized, wait, that was the punchline. That was the point of the story. It is over. So I thought it was quite a waste of time under the circumstances. He's genial. He's nice. He does have appeal. All that is in place. And I was amazed to find out later he's 80 or 81, depending on what source you use, because he doesn't remotely seem that old, neither in looks nor in energy. So that much is in place. And there is a charm about him. But the famous expression of it ain't on the page, it ain't on the stage, applies to his script here. And I'm very sorry for his fans that he didn't have more Star Trek stories, because I think that's what they come out to see. And so ultimately, it was one of those shows where I went, I sat there, I went home. So I wish I could be more enthusiastic, but that's pretty much the extent of it for me.
So it is a national tour, and he's going around. It's quite shocking how it seems quite shocking how quickly it scrambled to get up a Broadway end up on Broadway. Is it really? Do you feel that it's really well thought out, or was it just a scramble to get it?
No, I think he's doing the show that he wants to do. I think he thinks it's more fascinating than I did. So I guess they saw this window of opportunity at the Music Box and said, why not? The words direct from Broadway still mean something. And you can always make those shows sound like hits, even if you've run only a few performances on Broadway. Also, it's one of those things where if it were successful, I imagine they'd extend a week or two, and they could ballyhoo that too. But to be perfectly frank, I didn't think the show was any better or worse than Suzanne Summers' show of a few years ago, The Blonde and the Thunderbird. It was a very similar feeling about it to me. Somebody who believed that what he had to say was truly profound, and no matter what he said, would be of great interest to anybody. And it just wasn't to me.
Well, you know, I remember years ago reading, I don't remember where, somebody identified this phenomenon in celebrities called them refuseniks. There are some celebrities who become famous and beloved for doing a certain thing, and then they just, through ego or whatever, decide to not give the public what they want. And to give them what they think they, you know, so if they become famous as a singer like Barbara Streisand, then she wants to become a director. In her case, she never stopped singing, so that's
right.
Not
no, but I know what you mean. I get your analogy. Yeah, yeah.
And it seems like that he's one of those. And it's so stupid. I remember Andrea McArdle told a wonderful story about how she had a period where she had an attitude about singing the song Tomorrow from Annie. You know, she was like, oh my God, all everyone wants to hear is that song. And apparently she was doing Jerry's Girls with Carol Channing at the time. Mm-hmm. And Carol Channing said to her, I'm not going to do the voice, although I'd love to. She said something like, don't you dare. She said, I don't want to hear you say that ever again. Do you realize what a gift that is, that you have a song that's associated with you and you alone? So you go out there and you sing that song for those people.
That's funny you say that, Michael, you know, because at the Theatre World Awards one year, she was a Theatre World Award winner for Annie in 1977. Mm-hmm. And we had asked her to come to the ceremony and sing Tomorrow, and she couldn't have been more gracious about it. She said it enthusiastically. Sure, I'll come. And while she was singing it, I thought to myself, gee, I wonder if she's tired. She must be tired of this song. She must be tired of asked to do this song. And here you are telling me that Carol Channing is really responsible for showing up at the Theatre World Awards and delivering a knockout rendition of the song. She couldn't have been nicer about it. She smiled when she went on. She smiled when she came off. She's always been lovely to me. And so that answers that question. So I guess I have Carol Channing to thank for that.
Well, yeah, she said she had a period where she felt really didn't like, you know, she had an attitude about it.
And I follow it. Yeah.
Yeah. And then Carol really just, she really appreciated what being told that, because and she thought about it and she thought, well, of course, you know, that she's right.
Isn't that something?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So I get, in a way that relates to, you know, William Shatner. It's like, you know, how silly of him not to talk more about Star Trek. It doesn't have to be the whole show.
No, but on the other hand, I mean, who knows? Maybe there just aren't that many interesting stories connected with it. One can't believe that that's the case, because it ran for a few years. I mean, I know it wasn't a smash hit series when it was on the air first run, prime time, but certainly he must have fascinating stories about even interaction with fans who come up to him and ask him these bizarre questions, or it must be, you know.
Oh, absolutely. And let's not forget that he was in the first movie of it, version of it, and which was directed by Robert Wise.
Yeah,
you know, right. I mean, so there's stories in that alone, I would think.
Sure. Yeah, right. You know, it'd be funny if we heard a Sound of Music story from William Shatner that he heard from Robert Wise. That would have been interesting. But I don't know. You know, I'm going to sound like I'm aggrandizing myself here, and I'll take the risk of that. But tomorrow night, I'm going to be in Lansdowne, Pennsylvania, doing the show that I do about the life of a critic. And when I finish, there isn't a dry eye in the house. But as I was watching this, I was thinking, you know, my stories are funnier than his. I mean, I really believe they are, you know. So what can I tell you? I mean, I may be wrong about that. And tomorrow night, people will walk out of the theater in Lansdowne, Pennsylvania, saying, geez, he's no William Shatner. But, I mean, who knows? You know, I mean, I don't know. So, but I'll tell you, he did get the adoration of the crowd anyway. I mean, he could have done anything up there that people were just thrilled to be in the same room with Captain Kirk. You know, that was it. That he had them in the palm of his hand just from showing up. You know, they couldn't believe their good fortune that after all these years, they would be in the same room with him. So, and I understand that we've all had that. You know, people were just glad to see it live. You know, it's significant. So,
also, I mean, you know, although it's logistically somewhat difficult, it seems to me this would have been a perfect opportunity for a Q&A session at the end.
Sure.
You know, with
sure.
with questions submitted beforehand, sure. maybe or whatever.
Yeah. If that needed to be, sure. But nevertheless, yeah, that would have they would have really been in heaven then. So,
yes.
Yeah.
Did they talk about Boston Legal and Danny Crane?
A little. Maybe as much as Star Trek. It was.
He really saved that show. I think he actually made more episodes of Boston Legal than he did of Star Trek.
Hmm.
So, that's probably true. People don't realize that Star Trek had such a very short television run.
I know it wasn't a hit when it first came out.
All right, so let's move forward. Michael went to see How I Learned to Drive at second stage?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Michael, tell us about that.
Well, How I Learned to Drive is a wonderful, wonderful Pulitzer Prize winning, deservedly Pulitzer Prize winning play by Paula Vogel that I saw the original production of with Mary Louise Parker and David Morse. And this is an excellent revival at second stage, directed by Kate Worski. It's for those who don't know, it's about an adult woman basically presenting to us this very, very odd relationship she had with her uncle, who wound up sexually abusing her. But the interesting thing about it is that it's not a black and white play. He's not presented as a complete monster. And we get to see how basically the family dynamic in which this woman lived, her nickname that the family gives her is Lil Bit. And she mentions how everyone in the family had a nickname that had something to do with basically with sex, so body parts or whatever. So there was this very unhealthy dynamic in the family to begin with, where everything was kind of sexualized. And so the abuse that she suffered at the hands of her uncle came as a result of that. And it's just very well written. This production, an excellent production. Elizabeth Reaser, whom many of our listeners may know from the Twilight movies, did a superb job as a Lil Bit. It's a difficult role because aside from everything else, she has to act like a young girl, sometimes as young as 12, throughout the show. And that can be, very difficult for an adult to do that with the way they speak and their inflections and their body language without seeming ridiculous. But she managed it very well. And Norbert Leo Butz was superb as Uncle Peck. David Morse and Mary Louise Parker were also great. I would say that both sets of leads were equally good, but and yet gave very different performances in certain ways. Norbert was much more of an overt charmer, and you could see the seductiveness of him. He did a really great job. Somebody who started out as a musical theater performer and still is, but also has proven himself to be an excellent actor in dramas and comedies and straight plays. But the one unfortunate thing on the night I attended was that it seemed to me there was a lot of very inappropriate laughter, and that is a sort of a line that this play intentionally skips across in many places, but I mean, because there is a humorous aspect of the highly inappropriate things that are going on in the family, but over and above that, it seemed like then when there were things that were really not intended to be funny, that the audience was still whooping it up. I think there must have been the night I attended. It seemed like there was a group of people who were friends with one or more of the ensemble
actors who are Kevin Cahoon, Jennifer Regan, and Marnie Schulenburg. Because every time they specifically said something, that there was a lot of whoops and hollers. And I just think that maybe, I don't know, I kind of sometimes wish there was an audience education class that people could go to learn what, you know, when maybe it's a little too much, you know, how far you can go in showing appreciation without becoming annoying to your fellow audience members. So that was too bad. But I will say, the production is so good and the play is so good that as it proceeded, eventually that laughter did stop. So Paula Vogel and the actors and the director really did draw everyone into this story. And at the end, you don't actually see the first abuse happen until very close to the end of the play. And of course, it's not that explicitly done, but it's certainly explicit enough that you know what's going on. And there, you could hear a pin drop at that point. I'm happy to say there was no nervous laughter then. So great job to everyone. Definitely try to get to see this production if you can.
You're right, Michael. The wonderful thing about this play is the fact that this is not a bad guy. This is a guy to whom something bad has happened. He means well. He truly loves her in his own way. And it's very sad that this is the case. It's so sad when he's writing her letters. There's a montage at the end where, you know, he says, only 44 days to go. You know, and he's really looking forward to meeting with her again after she's moved away. And she doesn't want this at all. And yet, you know, there he is. He is so sincere about all this that you really have to pity him. You don't come away saying, what a sleaze.
Right.
You come away saying, what a shame.
Right.
You know, and that's what makes the play so successful.
Another point is that she, in this production, and I believe the first one is, if I remember, she is presented when she is a very young girl as sort of I don't want to say a Lolita, but some, you know, like one of those young people who behave seductively without maybe even realizing what they're doing.
Sure.
And also in this case, as I said, she's grown up in this family that's where everything is sexualized. So maybe she's kind of responding to that. So that's another thing. It's like here, you know, here this guy is, he's had his own awful problems in life. He's lived in the middle of this family where everyone is always talking about sex. And then there's this, you know, beautiful young girl who's behaving seductively. So it's like, even though it's still wrong, you know, it's not as if we can't see why the tragedy happened.
Sure.
The complications of theater and presenting complex arguments that are not as straightforward as we see in, you know, 40-minute episodes on television.
Yeah.
This is why we go to the theater.
Yes.
It is.
This is why we, this is how we learn as a society. It's playing at Second Stage through March 11th. I'm looking at the calendar here. I don't know where the marketing people's minds were. Maybe this is just me making this up in my head, but they're having a wine tasting after the March 3rd performance. The 2 p.m., they have a 2 p.m. and an 8 p.m. They have a wine tasting after the 2 p.m. performance. So
really? After the 2?
After the 2.
Well, actually, I should, yeah, I mean.
And they have a show the next day, so.
Well, yeah, I mean, I should mention that when I arrived for the performance the other day, there was a reception in the bar area of the theater, and it said that it was closed for a private reception, and those people then came into the theater. And I should also mention, like, at the last moment, in fact, the curtain was held a little bit to get everyone in. So I think that's partly the issue, because I think those people were, some of them were liquored up before the show, and that partly accounted for the some of the inappropriate responses.
I wonder if Ernest and Julio Gallo are sponsoring How I Learned to Drive.
I remember when Liquor came into the theater and with bars actually there, because when you think of it, think of the movie of the producers where they repair across the street to the bar. Bars essentially started in the theater in 1964. And I remember that because Beatrice Lilly was doing High Spirits at the time. And she said, you know, ever since they put bars in the theater, our laughs during the second act are just a little bit longer than they were before they put bars in the theater. So that's how I know it was the summer of 64 they came in.
I never ever buy anything at intermission. People, you know, much less a soda or anything else. I was reading on all that chat on Talking Broadway.
Oh, that, God, you got to bring this up. This, if we get into this, yeah, we should, though. We should just mention it.
We're talking about the $15
yes.
Cola collectible Schubert Cup. Was that it?
Or? Yes, I went to see High with Kathleen Turner. And I almost never, like you, I almost never buy anything at intermission just because, I don't know, it seems like it's not a time to drink it and whatever. Yeah. But my friend wanted a Coke, and it was $10, wow. I think.
So this was real cocaine then, right?
I mean,
I think you were at Studio 54.
Well, their rationale on that day anyway was that they were serving it to you in a sippy cup, which you could then bring back to your seat. I don't know if in that case, but a lot of the sippy cups are actually like quote unquote souvenir cups with the mm-hmm. with the logo of the play on them. Mm-hmm. I don't know if High had that. But anyway, but you don't have the option. I said, you know, and I said, you know, he ordered it and they said $10. I said, what? I said, well, you know, and they explained the reason. I said, well, can't he just get it in a regular little plastic cup? And then said, oh no, sorry, we don't do that anymore.
Yeah. Those days are gone. Yeah.
That's silly. You know, it. Anyway, this is a discussion of theater, not of mm-hmm. crazy things. All right, so let's move on to other wonderful things that are out there. Michael had a chance to listen to the Godspell cast recording, and it'd come out a few months ago or so. Is it that long ago?
I think about one month.
Month ago, and we had talked about it. So, Michael, why don't you tell us about the Godspell cast recording?
Well, yeah, I actually went to a CD release event for it a couple of weeks ago at Barnes & Noble, but I didn't actually get the recording at that point, and I only picked it up a few days ago. And it's really wonderful. You might think you don't need to hear another recording of Godspell. I already have several, but... two main reasons to get this one. Really, really excellent new arrangements by Michael Holland, who I have seen perform in cabaret many times with his cohort Karen Mack. They have a show called, it's got a terrible title, it's called Gashole, Gashole. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why they call it that. But anyway, they do tributes to various eras of music, the 80s, the 90s, whatever. But this is, I think, his first Broadway credit. And he did a superb job of honoring the music and lyrics and the original arrangements to some degree, but creating something very new that sounds fresh and interesting without destroying it. I will say it's not, there's not the simplicity of the original arrangements, which are, it's basically just for a rock band, like a four piece, maybe five piece rock band. These are more, somewhat more elaborate, but I think not in a gimmicky way. When you first hear them, you might, you know, it takes a moment to adjust because they are quite different, but beautiful, beautiful harmonies and arrangements and slightly different tempos and things like that. That's a major reason to get it. And the other one is Hunter Parrish, who has a really, really beautiful voice. I mean, an exceptionally beautiful voice, I think. As I think I've mentioned in the past, he does... seemed to have, when I saw the show, he seemed to be having a little bit of a problem when he had to sing really high and really loud. That's not his forte. But any other time, it's a beautiful sound, very, very lyrical and with a lot of heart in it, and just perfect for Jesus. So he's a standout here. He's not the only one. I mean, everyone is really terrific on the album. Telly Leung, I would single out. He sings All Good Gifts. But it's definitely an album I would not hesitate in adding it to your collection.
All right. So, Peter, how many recordings of Godspell are there out there, do you think?
Well, I don't know if there are all that many. In this house, we have the original cast, we have the soundtrack, we have that 40th anniversary, which links both of them. And then there was also another one done on J Records some time ago. There was also a revival of that one that it showed up on Finsworth Alley Records, the revival that was done off-Broadway in 2000. I believe that's the one that started in that theater space near the Empire State Building and then moved to the York.
Yeah, right.
So so that's what I know. I mean, that's still a lot.
That was the one with Barrett Foa, and then at the same almost exact same time as that one, which was odd, another recording came out, which was of a tour that had been going around, and that one was that's the least successful recording, because everything is all the score is kind of reimagined as this kind of electronics techno synth thing, and I don't really like that one very much at all, but that's out there too. And then there's also, I'm sure it's been out of print for decades, but there is a London cast, which is interesting because it's got Julie Covington on it and David Essex, and Judas is Jeremy Irons. So so there have been quite a few recordings. It's just that maybe not all of them are available at the moment.
Yeah, my girlfriend saw that production in London at a matinee and was so taken with it, she went back that very night to see it again. So she talks a great deal about Jeremy Irons being a terrific Judas. That's with those names, it is interesting that it went out of print and that somebody doesn't get that one back in print, given the marquee value of those names. But we do. Godspell is very well represented. Though frankly, I think it deserves it. I think it's a phenomenal score.
Yeah.
I never tire of it, and it was. I still remember vividly where I was and who I was when I listened to it first when it came out in 1971, and I was crazy for it. So, and I still am, and it's fine. I'm glad to hear this recording is good. I haven't heard it, but I'm glad to hear it's good, Michael.
Oh yeah, and as I think we mentioned before, the recording was tremendously popular, and that's one of the last instances where a recording from a cast album became a top 40 hit. I think one of the last, maybe the only one after that was, and I am telling you, I'm not going.
And what's really nice, too, about that is the fact that it's very hard for an off-Broadway show to have a cast album that sells well. And it was funny because when Day by Day became the breakout hit, the name of the group, and I put quotation marks around the group, was Godspell. That's what it said on the 45 record that was released. You know, not the original cast of Godspell or anything like that. Maybe they felt that would taint it and people would stay away from this record. But if we made it sound like a rock group named Godspell, then maybe people would buy the 45. And indeed they did. Anyway, and of course, it was the debut of a very significant musical theater writer, and that is, of course, Stephen Schwartz. It was funny when I saw Pippin in London a few weeks ago. There's a line at the end of Pippin that Pippin himself sings about something like, "I thought life would be magic shows," and all I could think of was the fact, you know, for Schwartz it has been magic shows, because he did his very next show after Pippin was called The Magic Show, and now here he is. He's doing a musical about Houdini, you know. So there's another magic show. So he did make that line turn out to be significant in his own life.
All righty. Next on our agenda is Myths and Hymns. Is it Prospect Theater Company, Michael, is that correct?
Yes.
All right. So Michael saw Myths and Hymns. Why don't you tell us about that?
Myths and Hymns was originally performed under the title Saturn Returns at the Public Theater in 1998, and it only had 6 performances there. 16 performances, I'm sorry. Not sure. I did not see it. I don't remember what happened. But it is basically a song cycle. And some of the songs are about most of the songs are about gods, you know, the stories of the gods and myths. Hero and Leander is one of the best and I guess maybe one of the most famous songs from it. But the production now, what's so interesting about it is that basically a narrative has been written around it. It never really had an overarching narrative before, but director and writer named Elizabeth Lucas has created a scenario where what happens is when we come into the theater and when the show begins, we see what looks like an attic, basically. And there's a woman, an older woman in a sort of a nightgown going through boxes. And then her daughter comes in and there's some dialogue from the daughter that makes clear that they're basically closing the house down and there's going to be an auction of the woman's possessions. And I guess we assume that she's going to a nursing home. I don't know if they actually say that or if she's going to live with the daughter. I think it was the former. And then as the woman goes through the boxes and finds books and photos, we then see the songs performed as if they were telling little scenarios of things that happened with among her family, she and her husband, how she met her husband, and then when the children as they grew up. And it's sort of relating the stories of the gods to family dynamics, kind of in the way of Stephen Schwartz's Children of Eden, which is about, it's about the Bible characters. But in this case, it's Greek and Roman gods, basically. So the scenario, I didn't think it always worked, but it was always interesting, never boring, and I think it did add to a lot of the meanings of the songs. There's a very, very strong cast here. Anika Larsson is the daughter. Bob Stillman is the husband. Lucas Steele, who has really one of the most beautiful voices in musical theater, is the son. Ali Bonino plays a character called the Trickster. Matthew Farcher is the lover, and Donnell James Foreman is the shapeshifter. So there's basically the people who play the family and then these other people who play various types of other characters. And last but certainly not least is Linda Balgord, who plays the central character, the woman, the one who's we see in the nightgown going through her effects. And the amazing thing about this, and I may have said this before, Linda Balgord is a really great performer and a great singer, very powerful singer. You may have seen her in the title just went out of my head.
Sunset Boulevard?
Yeah, well, yes, but also the Pirate Queen.
Uh-huh.
The Pirate Queen, which didn't last very long. Yes, she did do Sunset Boulevard on tour. That's the kind of performer she is. She has a magnificent voice that can really, really get you. You know, she can really belt it, but she also can, you know, rein it back and sing beautifully. In this show, she does not sing, nor does she say a word until the last 10 minutes or so, when she finally sings a song called Awaiting You. And it's so effective to have this person not speak or sing until the end, and then all of the emotion comes out in this one song. And I've always wondered about that. I've always said that I thought that would be a tremendously effective thing to do. The only other example I can think of is Finian's Rainbow, where the rather minor character of Susan the Silent dances all through the show, and then finally at the end she sings. Although I can't remember now, Peter, is that only in the movie?
No. I'll tell you another one that comes to mind, though, and that is a musical nobody talks about anymore, but it's a very entertaining Castellum, and that's The Tap Dance Kid. The father has sung all night, and at least that. I mean, he speaks, of course, which is not quite the same thing you're talking about. But nevertheless, it is very powerful at the end when he comes out with a real harangue in song. So that came to mind. I'll admit it's not quite what you're talking about, but nevertheless, if I can get anybody to listen to the album of The Tap Dance Kid with music by Henry Krieger, who did Green Girls, I always try to do it. So that's why I'm shoving that in here and shoehorning it into the conversation. Sorry, I'll be quiet.
Oh, no, thanks. No, I actually do not know that show. But thank you for telling me that. No, I think it's a tremendously effective device. And in this case, obviously, it was sort of done after the fact, because the show was not necessarily written with this central character who doesn't sing until the end. But that's how Elizabeth Lucas has reconceived it, and I think it's very, very effective. But the last thing I want to say is the score is magnificent. It's by Adam Gettle, and he is the perfect example of a writer who writes challenging, I guess, music, but it's not forbidding. It's not, you know, it's not impenetrable. It's not even remotely like that. It's just not, it's a little complex. It's not simple. It's not like what you go when you go to see Memphis. But it rewards, it tremendously rewards your time, you know, in listening to it, seeing it performed live in the context of a show, and then getting the recording and listening to it and examining it, and your appreciation for it will only grow with each listening, much like Sondheim. So there is a recording of this under the title Myths and Hymns, with, by the way, an all-star cast. Adam Gettle himself, Audra McDonald, Mandy Patinkin, Kristen Chenoweth, Vivian Cherry, Billy Porter, and Teresa McCarthy. So I'm pretty sure that's probably still in print, and if not, I'm sure you can find it anyway. Pick that up, because it's just a beautiful, beautiful piece, and the kind of thing that we need to, you know, pay attention to and support. I'm happy to hear that Adam Gettle apparently now has several projects that he's working on at once. As you all may know, he is not the most prolific writer in the world. He had worked on for several years on an adaptation of The Princess Bride, and that was unfortunately scuttled because of some disagreement with William Goldman, the book writer. Now he does apparently have several things that he's working on, so I can't wait to hear those. I really cannot wait.
All righty, that's Adam's work is not seen enough, you know.
Yeah.
Next on our agenda, we were going to talk about Michael. Last week we talked about Merrily. Peter saw it, and this week Michael saw it. So, Michael, why don't you tell us, you know, in comparison to Peter's discussion last week, what you think about Merrily?
Well, I think this is a inconsistent production of an inconsistent show is the shortest way to put it. But there's so much in this show that is so wonderful, specifically the score, that it kind of almost makes the flaws fade into the background. I do think that, especially in the rewritten version, the fact that the story is told backwards, I think that it has entailed a little bit of kind of obvious sledgehammery stuff in some of the book, some of the lines, to make it clear to the audience what's happening. And it's perfectly understandable. Unfortunately, this production is directed by James Lapine. I'm not a fan, and I don't think that he was the best choice for this, because I think he tends to also take a very kind of unsubtle, sledgehammery approach, and that just kind of exacerbated that flaw in the script. I thought that the three leads were wonderful. Were really wonderful. Colin Donnell, the role of Frank Shepard is again very difficult, because comes across as somewhat unsympathetic, and he can seem very kind of bland, and we're not always sure how talented he's supposed to be, but I thought he did a really great job of it, and made the character very believable and sympathetic. The other two, Lin-Manuel Miranda, it would have been nice if he had a slightly stronger voice, especially for Franklin Shepard Inc., that amazing, amazing number. But he acted it so well that it was not that much of an issue. And I thought I guess I would say I disagree with Peter about Celia Keenan Bulger. I thought she was very warm and wonderful. She did seem slightly still under the weather vocally to me. I mean, I've heard her sing before, and it just sounded like she had a cold, basically, is what it sounded like. So maybe it was still the after effects of what Peter heard. It didn't sound like any kind of a, you know, major chronic vocal problem. I certainly hope not. But she just was so sympathetic, and I thought she was great. Even in the first scene where she has to be a falling down drunk, that's a very, very, very difficult scene, and I thought she managed the transition backwards beautifully, and it was so touching at the end, because when she when she was no longer wearing the wigs and other accoutrements to make her look older, she really, in the final scene, she looked like she could have been a 17-year-old practically, and the innocence of that, and just that scene on the rooftop, which is so beautiful, it really, really brought it home emotionally. There's something interesting about James Lapine. It seems he has a somewhat of a history of tinkering with other people's shows in terms of the writing of them, and then not taking credit for it, which I guess maybe he thinks of as noble. But and really, I think that's happened many times. In this case, he is not credited as a co-book writer for Merrily We Roll Along. The original book was by George Firth, but apparently starting in the 80s, I think, or the late 80s, early 90s, Lapine started to sort of instigate changes in the book. And they continue up until this version, which George Firth is now deceased, so he obviously didn't have a hand in it. But there are some major changes in this version, including and most especially in the final scene, where in this version now we are led to believe that Frank and Charlie meet for the first time on this rooftop as they're waiting to see Sputnik go over, whereas in the original version that it was not the case. They had already known each other for several years from high school, I believe, and that's a big change, and I'm not sure it's for the better. But at any rate, yeah, and Lapine, he became involved in the show Dirty Blonde, I think, after it was initially conceived, and in that case, he's now credited with conceiving it. And when he directed a revival of The Diary of Anne Frank, there was a major change, a major addition to the end of the show, an epilogue in which Anne Frank's father told in very horrific, specific detail what happened to her in the camps, which I thought was a tremendous mistake, and I still do. So I don't know. I personally don't know if I feel comfortable with the way that he becomes involved with other people's properties and either rewrites them himself or gets them to rewrite them. It's kind of an odd thing. It's almost like a show doctor, but it's a little different. And I don't know that the things that he has added to Merry Re-Roll Along have necessarily improved it. But in any event, the score remains the reason to see it. And the audience just loved it at Encores, I thought. And it had a twice as long a run as any other show has ever had at Encores. I think they anticipated that the demand would be great. And from what I hear, there was a plan to there was a real hope that this production would transfer to Broadway. And from what I hear, again, it's not going to happen because the reviews were not quite good enough for that. But maybe we'll see it on Broadway again sometime. I don't know in what version. In the meantime, there are a number of recordings of Merrily also that one can listen to. So get the album, at least, if you can't see it.
Well, the reviews were not great, but they weren't really a disaster.
Oh, no. But I mean, this is just, again, what I've heard. I guess they felt that they needed...
I don't think it'll transfer either, but... one thing that is going to happen is that we are going to transfer over to Seth Rudetsky's Disaster. And Michael got a chance to see Seth in his newest endeavor. Michael wanted to tell us about that.
It doesn't have many performances. It's at the Triad up on 72nd Street. It's absolutely delightful. I think I might have mentioned it in passing last week. I felt like I did. Or maybe it was before we started recording, but it's basically a takeoff, a spoof of the disaster films of the 70s, films like primarily The Poseidon Adventure, but you know, with elements of others, and written around the biggest song hits of the time. But I mean, I'm telling you, there have got to be at least parts of 60 songs in this show. You know, every pop hit of the 70s, good or bad or indifferent, is set up. And what they do, which is hilarious, is they will set up something with a few lines of dialogue, you know, like references to things, and you don't even know what they're necessarily talking about. And then suddenly they'll burst into one of the cheesiest songs of the 70s. And then the audience, you know, just falls out of its chairs laughing because it's been set up. It's funny because if you see Mamma Mia, which I know is one of mine and James' least favorite shows, there are times in that where the audience laughs, it wasn't intended by the authors, because the songs come in just such a, they're so shoehorned into the silly plot that doesn't make any sense anyway, and the audience just laughs. And but here that is the effect that is sought. It's a total spoof, and so hilariously done. At one point, near the end, the young couple who are at the center of it, they start to launch into a love ballad, and they get about five words into it, and Seth Rudetsky, who's also in the show, says, "We don't have time for that now." They stop, mm-hmm. and they go on to the next thing.
Don't you wish that some Broadway shows would do that, though? We don't have time for that right now, and you move on to something else.
I saw the show with Gerard Alessandrini, and that got the biggest laugh from him, because it was just so well done. I mean, because how many times do you feel that? You know, sometimes in a musical, let's face it, if it's not well, if the song is not well set up, you can think, oh my God, are they going to sing again? You know, if it doesn't seem like a place where they should. And that's exactly what happened here. And the audience, it stopped the show when he said, "We don't have time for that."
It's very, very Monty Python.
Yes, yes.
Is it Holy Grail when the boy is up in the tower and he's trying to sing and they kept on stopping the big ballad from happening? So, so Seth's show is planned for another few weeks up at the Triad, and you know, as we've mentioned before, he's such a great talent, and he's such a diverse person. I want to point out that as well as all the other things that he's doing, he is putting together the Broadway Spectacular. Have you heard about this?
Mm-mm.
The Broadway Spectacular is Tony Awards weekend, June 8th through 11th, 2012 in New York City. You are invited to the biggest Broadway Spectacular weekend party. Seth and 100 of his favorite people or so are going to go see Porgy and Bess and Evita and what else are they going to go see here? Let me see. Their agenda is, let's see, first Friday, June 8th, they're going to go see Evita. On Saturday, June 9th, is called Broadway Bantering with Unlimited Non-Alcoholic Beverages. And he's going to get together with Michael Cerveris and Joshua Henry and Andrea Burns and Anna Gasteyer. And then they're going to go see Porgy and Bess. And then Spider-Man, and then the Tony Awards. And for a mere $999 per person, you could be a part of this as well.
Wow.
So I just saw this. He posted it on Facebook, and he's ramping it up. He's always got five or six coals, irons in the fire.
Yes.
You have to have coals in the fire as well, but he's got irons in the fire.
And he's also in the news because news just came, I think, maybe yesterday. I don't know if you both know this, but the L.A. Reprise series is coming to an end.
Oh, I didn't hear that.
Yes, which is really sad news. Jason Alexander had been the, I guess, the artistic director for some years. But the reason Seth apparently is doing one of his deconstructing shows, which are fantastic. And that is going on as, I guess, what may be the last Reprise event. I mean, you know, they primarily do, it's an encore style thing. They do stage, well, they do more fully staged, although nowadays encores is pretty fully staged too. You know, productions of underappreciated musicals, but they have other events too. And Seth is going to do one of his deconstructing things coming up. And I should mention, by the way, Disaster was co-written with Jack Plotnick, whom Seth has worked with for many years on several projects. So I didn't want to leave him out because the book is the one of the, well, in this case, I mean, it's the thing that makes it so special. It's, you know what? It's kind of like, Rock of Ages, except even more spoofy and even more, even funnier. So if you love Rock of Ages, I think you'll love this show. It except that it's 70s music instead of 80s. That's the primary difference.
All right. So we're going to do a few news items in a minute. But before we do that, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayStars.com. And on the right-hand side, there's a Broadway Radio section. In that section, you can click a subscribe button. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of Broadway Radios This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. That way, you won't miss anything. You can also listen to us on the Stitcher app, which is Stitcher, which is available for your iPhone, your iPod Touch, your Android phones, your Blackberries. That way you can stream our podcasts to your device without downloading them and not miss anything as well. You can also listen to us on Broadway World Radio, Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m., or you can go to BroadwayRadio.com and click on the link there and just listen to it directly on your computer. If you go to Broadway Radio, there'll be all the contact information for Michael, Peter, and myself, as well as links to different articles and things that we've talked about on today's show. We had some very sad news right after we finished recording last week that Zena Bethune had passed away. Peter, do you want to talk a little about Zena Bethune? I know that you're a big fan of Grand Hotel, and she was a big part of that.
That's right. I certainly was a big fan of Grand Hotel, which still remains as the musical I've seen the most, 17 times. And certainly I saw Zine and Bethune. And I later heard when I interviewed Bob Wright and Chet Forrest, who provided much of the score of Grand Hotel, that they believed that Zina Bethune was the best to ever play the role of Grushinskaya, the ballerina, and because she could act it the best. And I agree with that. I thought there was really something in her performance. The pathos was there in a way that I hadn't seen before. She came in very, very late in the run. The only time I had really ever heard of this woman was in a TV series in the 60s called The Nurses, which she did with Cheryl Conway, which is a name that musical theater enthusiasts will recognize as the leading lady of Plain and Fancy, a 1950s musical. But so she was a revelation. I didn't watch The Nurses when I was a kid, and so I had no knowledge of who she was, but she really made me sit up and take notice in Grand Hotel. So, and the story is so terrible about how this happened, because what had happened was she was very much an animal lover, and she saw a wounded animal by the road, and she got out to help it, and a hit and run driver hit her and did not stop. Needless to say, if he's a hit and run driver, so it's a terrible set of circumstances. And I wish she had done more Broadway, but at least we did get to see her at least that one time. She may have done other Broadway shows that I'm unaware of, but I can't recall her doing any in the time that I've been paying attention. So, but what a shame. And I know people who knew her well and said she was really quite a lovely human being. Now, this is not something I heard last week, when people always say that people who have died were lovely human beings. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had heard during the run of Grand Hotel that the cast was really quite crazy about her. So, so it's really very sad to have had this happen.
Yeah, it's a... unbelievable tragedy. It's just an unbelievable tragedy that this type of thing happened in the hit and run driver.
Sure.
Other things that happened last week after we finished recording was that Scott Rudin joined the EGOT Club, which is an Emmy, a Grammy, an Oscar, and a Tony. He got his Grammy last week when Book of Mormon took the category for best cast recording. And
I hate this acronym EGOT. I hate it because Tony is the last one mentioned. I think it should be called the Togi Award.
I see a column there, don't we?
Yeah, so that's what I would like to see. I think that's really significant that we have that. But nevertheless, yeah. Some of these people who have it, I mean, I don't know if you should really count this for Scott Rudin, because I think Grammy really should be more in the creative aspect. I mean, like if he had written the music to this, that would be more significant to me. But I see those awards basically as going to people who did the writing of the acting. I guess I'm being finicky about that, but
I don't know if I would compare Scott Rudin to a John Kander. You know, they're both excel in their own way, but John Kander, I feel, is a true EGOT.
I would think that if you were to include producers, I would think there would be more EGOTs. But I guess not, because they wouldn't win in other fields, I guess.
I don't think, by the way, John Kander qualifies. I don't think he won an Oscar. I could be wrong about that, but I don't think
we
so.
We talked about it when he was on the podcast here.
He won an Oscar? Yeah, really? I didn't realize that. For what, in fact? I can't think of anything.
Was it for New York, New York?
Yeah, I think.
No, I don't even think that song got nominated that year, by the way. Alone won the Oscar. I think that song needed Frank Sinatra to make it happen. That only became a real standard after Sinatra did his recording, which was a very good recording.
True. Yeah.
So I don't even think it was nominated. Again, we may get emails galore saying, "You damn fool, how can you say that?" But but that's my memory of it. In fact, I think I even remember a scandal that Helen Reddy had a song that was nominated that year, and she said, "I don't know why my song got nominated in New York didn't." That's a story I think I recall hearing at the time. Again, I may be thinking of something else entirely, but that rings a bell to me.
I'm checking here.
I'm looking at Wikipedia, and Wikipedia says that John is missing the Academy Award. That they call it a three-got. He doesn't have a full E-got. He's got a three-got.
I didn't think he won an Oscar, you know, and that's too bad, you know.
I thought we had talked about it, but I have to go back and listen to that episode. Perhaps I said it was an EGOT, and I was incorrect at that time.
Jonathan Tunick is an EGOT, and when I talked with him about it, he said that he keeps hearing every time he hears that the number of people changes, and I don't mean that because people are being added, but it's I think maybe people use different criteria as to whether someone should be included.
It's apparently about
a dozen people.
Yeah. All right. Also in the news last week was that Michael Riedel is writing about Matilda, who Peter had gone to London and told us about the great things of Matilda. So Riedel is backing up Felicia there and saying that everybody's scrambling to get Matilda to Broadway. What do you think, Peter?
I think it'll be interesting to see how it does here, because one of the things that's very vital to Matilda is the school marm is played by a man in a very, very specific British pantomime tradition that really means something to the people over there. It's going to lose a little in translation here, maybe not enough, and maybe people say, "Oh, another female impersonator, how funny." We've become so used to female impersonators. I mean, I remember so vividly when I saw Chicago in 1975 that when Mary Sunshine undressed and showed that she was actually a he, the audience was startled. They were fooled. They couldn't believe it. And now every time I go to see Chicago, as soon as Mary Sunshine comes on, I hear somebody whispering to somebody else, "It's a man." You know, so we've become inured to drag over these years, and it may not pose a problem, but it seems so specifically British to me that I can understand why it's successful over there. Anyway, the other parts of Matilda, with the exception of the score, which I don't think is as good as it could be, but the heart of the and soul of the show is there, and it may do reasonably well here. But my prediction would be that, like Billy Elliot, if it's a success, it won't be as big a success as it has been in London. That's my early prediction on Matilda.
Sure. All righty.
Another piece of news was that Leslie Uggams has been cast in Pipe Dream at Encores.
Yeah, and one of my friends said, I wonder if that's a good idea. She hasn't had good luck with Oscar Hammerstein lyrics. I will go no more into that than that. Some listeners will know what I'm talking about, some won't, but we'll just leave it at that.
Julie Taymor reached a settlement with the Spider-Man production, which has been chronicled in many, many articles on many, many different websites. So we just want to mention it in passing that it happened here. Also, Sleepless in Seattle, the musical, which was going to be playing out in development at the Playhouse, has been postponed. Is usually a death sentence, but we'll see what happens.
Postponed can mean euphemism for canceled, certainly. Yeah. But I wish well. I think it's a very good property for musicalization. And Michael Garron, who wrote the music to Song of Singapore, came up with nice stuff there. So I'm hoping that he'll come up with nice stuff again.
Yeah. You guys have any plans to see CQCX?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Michael?
The Jason Blair story. Yeah.
I saw it.
Oh, you saw it?
Yeah, yeah. And briefly, I thought it was. Oh, I'm sorry.
No. I was going to say that maybe. Well, Pete, are you going to see it this week coming up?
Well, frankly, I've seen it too. So this is a perfect segue to say next week we'll talk about it.
Okay. So
yeah,
next week. Yeah, next week we'll talk about it. And I want to talk about what an absolutely terrible title that is, and it probably does not serve the production well, And, you know, I've worked in media and publishing, and I know what CQ and CX means, but that's ridiculous that that's the title of the show. So we'll talk about that next week.
All right.
So
by the way, this is interesting. I had heard, you know, I knew that it opened on Wednesday night, and I didn't have a hard copy of the Times, but and I obviously wanted to see their review of it because aside from everything else, it's about the Times. The show is about the New York Times. And I went online, and it was the first time I could not find the review through the search function. Maybe that has something to do with the weird title. Maybe the way I typed it in, you know, like, I mean, I typed it in exactly, but maybe somebody typed it in with a space or so, or I don't know, or the, maybe the dash, the slash.
The slash from a technical perspective can cause a problem in searches.
If it's not
implemented correctly on the technical side.
Yeah.
All right, so more for us to talk about next week. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Have a great week. Bye-bye.
Night. Bye.